Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned, and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. Today I'm interviewing Francis Dinner of OpenVPN. He is a bit of a badass, really. He grew up in Iraq and had to run away and escape and live in Baghdad for a while, and then managed to move into Europe and eventually to Silicon Valley, where he ended up founding his company OpenVPN. Yeah, one of the biggest VPN providers in the world, and he's doing pretty well for himself, and he's got a lot of cool life stories, as you might imagine. Bit of a cool guy with some pretty big life lessons. Going to unpack those with you on the podcast. So enjoy, and thanks, Francis, for coming on. Welcome to the podcast. It's my pleasure to have you here. So I'm going to mess up the quote. Losers quit when they fail and winners fail till they succeed.
Yes, you got it.
Good. Totally good. I tried to internalize that. But following that theme, can you try and tell me your life story and life story in 4 minutes and just indicate a few places where you picked up that philosophy?
Okay, so that philosophy, I picked it up since, obviously, I was born in Northern Iraq. And Northern Iraq, we had to escape Northern Iraq because of the war. I was only 5 years old. Then I went to Baghdad. So we have to start all over. And you can't just give up. And my family didn't have much. So I have to survive. So I was selling cigarettes. When I was 11 years old, I was selling cigarettes in the street of Baghdad to survive. And then from there, obviously, I was able to get my education. But then we had a very brutal dictatorship government and very authoritarian that I didn't like the system. So I had to leave Iraq for some reasons and escape to Sweden, apply for political asylum in Sweden. Didn't give up there either. I say, well, I finish my degree. So that's what I did. I got my degree, master in computer engineering and electrical engineering. And I was very determined. So then when I was in Sweden, I was working there and basically, you know, I was thinking, wow, I'm going to be making a lot of money because, you know, this is Sweden, this is great. But I never felt that I was making so much money, but I was feeling poor because all the taxes and all that, you're in a high bracket. So, okay, anyhow. So I from there came to U.S. and, you know, the U.S., I had the opportunity and to work for an American company. I was very much inspired by the whole system of really people starting their own business and entrepreneurship and so on. I was still working for a company, but then after that, I decided to start on my own. Not everything turned out to be very, you know, successful. I've got a few failures throughout my life. And sometimes you get to the point where you say, well, gee, I'm going to give up. But I never gave up, right? It doesn't matter. Even at my age right now, I never give up. Life is like a journey. You just have to incorporate a lot of things into your life, incorporate the habits that you have to develop to make you successful. So a lot of people would say, well, gee, now I made my money. Yesterday, actually, I had just a meeting with a few people here and say, well, now I exit. I made a lot of money. Now I have millions of dollars and now I can focus on my health. And the person is in his 60s. And I said, well, yeah, that's great. You can do that. But these things you have to incorporate in your lifestyle. If you get up to 60 and you have that really lifestyle of not being healthy, it's very hard to really change it. So as you go, basically what you do, you incorporate these things into your life. You basically strengthen your knowledge, you strengthen your health, you strengthen your view about everything. And the only way you're going to do it is through failure. I mean, that's part of the evolution. We are basically an evolving and that's part of our evolution. So we can't change that, right? So that's what makes you to really, I would say, a good and a successful entrepreneur and a good human being, you know. I came from, Assyrian family. Assyrian, we are Christian Catholic. We speak different language. We don't speak Arabic. We speak Aramaic, by the way. So you're in Nazareth. So Aramaic is very close to Hebrew. So, you know, we escaped Iraq because of persecution and went to Sweden, a great country as well. And but at the same time, not many opportunities for being an entrepreneur, and especially for being an immigrant, it's difficult to be in a Scandinavian country. It wasn't that easy. And then coming to the U.S. and say, wow, this is great. Like, I feel this is my country. It's a melting pot. It's like you've got different colors, different religions. So that's really inspired me a lot.
Yeah, wow, that was a really interesting story. Thanks for explaining it all. Definitely the embodiment of growth mindset and constantly developing and learning and never sort of saying that you're perfection, just keep on getting closer and closer. And it's cool.
Yeah, and never give up.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, it'd be kind of nice to kind of go through and unpack some of these things. What do you remember life being like back in Iraq and Baghdad then?
So there are two parts of my life in Iraq. There's the part of my childhood, which I remember a little bit of my childhood in northern Iraq. And my parents were farmers. So that was a good life, with the exceptions of when the war broke between the government and the Kurdish. And all I remember is bombing and airplanes and killings. And so we had to escape. And then growing in Baghdad was very tough for me, because when I was 5 years old and came to Baghdad, I didn't speak the language. So we spoke at home Assyrian Aramaic, very old language. And at the same time, you come to a society and then it's a different language now. You have to learn the language. And I was 5, 6 years old. So basically, I have to go to school and they register me in the school, and then I didn't speak the language. So I have to learn the hard way, right? The other thing, of course, the religion you have is different than the most majorities there. It's obviously, you know, it's a more an Islamic society and all that. So it's difficult. So we had to move from one neighborhood to a different neighborhood to make sure they, you know, culturally we're closer to Assyrian. So my experience during childhood, it was a little bit tough. But I think growing up, going through high school and all that, there are always changes in that country, political changes. So that political dramas we have in Iraq, moving from one political system to different political system, it was very brutal. It's not like there was any election. It was more about killing and conquering and taking over, right? I never liked that system. But at the same time, growing up, I got inspired by music. So, you know, I started playing guitar. I formed a band. And I was more interested in the Western music. I was more interested in Beatles, Tom Jones, the 70s and the 80s. And that's what I did, you know. I remember my memory in Baghdad. I was almost living a different life. It's almost I was thinking, well, I'm going to move out of this country because this is not how I want to live. So I was pretty much very rebellious, had a long hair and, you know, play guitar. And I just want to have a free society. And
yes, this was like the 60s, 70s?
Yeah, that was insane. I actually left Iraq in 1977. So that was in the 70s, yeah. 60s, during 60s and 70s, I was pretty much in Iraq. So late 70s, I escaped. I went to Sweden. So, yeah, while I enjoyed that part of my life, you know, going to school and education and the university and the family, and also having to be with the Assyrian, with the learning the music and having the band. It was a lot of fun, you know, playing different, you know, weddings and all that. So I was able to kind of, you know, balance that between the music and between my education. So I had to make a decision. What should I pursue, engineering or music? So I decided I'm going to pursue engineering because I saw most of my friends in music didn't do very well.
Do you ever regret that sometimes and think, oh, perhaps maybe I could have made it? Or,
well, it's never too late, right? No, I'm just joking. It's never too late. No, actually, I don't. So luckily, I've got one daughter. She is more into the music. So it's amazing. One daughter I have, she's very much an entrepreneur mind person. And she works, she runs the marketing. She's a head of the marketing at OpenVPN. And she used to be in the PR business. And then I have another daughter, she's a jazz singer. So she has way, way better talent than me and better voice than me. And she's amazing.
That's cool. managed to rub off on your children. And it's sort of amazing to think, as in, I guess, from the Western world, when you only really hear bad news, you don't think that anyone could be being creative in like war-torn countries and things. You sort of think that everyone's just like just about barely surviving kind of thing. You don't think that anyone's got time to actually have like aspirations and other dreams and thinking about doing nice things. I don't want to like put you down. Obviously you had like lots of difficult things going on, but you know what I mean? It's, we don't really get the full picture of what life's like exactly. So it's quite interesting just to be able to hear what your actual story was like.
Yeah, for me, growing in Iraq, everything else happening around me, right? Because I was inspired about music, I was inspired about science, the NASA. I was watching all these things, what's happening in the world, right? And then yet around me, everything is about killing and basically hanging people on the street. And for me, that was all noise. It didn't really, because a lot of people thought, well, how come you don't have post-traumatic stress disorder? I said, well, I don't have it. I don't know. I mean, I just like, I want to get out of here. I mean, this is for me. I cannot fix it. You know, yeah, I mean, I can fight it. I mean, a lot of people stayed there, fought it. But then the fight, of course, you're not going to be able to survive that system, even until now. I mean,
yeah. Do you think we sort of overprotect children in some ways? Because it's funny how you could have such a mental childhood compared to what most people have in like the Western world these days. And you've come out pretty okay, it seems. I mean, I haven't spent a lot of time with you. Maybe you're mental, but I think you seem to be pretty all right. And yet we're so concerned about what we can do to our children and not letting them have like any sort of slightly negative problems towards them because it might harm their psychology or something. Do you think that's actually maybe setting them up for worse problems because they can't deal with anything?
Well, I think it's a balance you have to maintain. So for every person is different. Definitely the environment is very important. But I agree. I mean, you develop the strength through really a hardship, right? I mean, think about it. When you're climbing the mountain, if you give up in the middle of the road, in the middle of climbing the mountain or hiking, I mean, you're very tired. It's part of our evolution. I mean, you have to go through hardship in order to gain that strength. So sometimes we don't allow our children to really gain that strength. We are very protective. So being too much protective is not very good, but obviously you don't want to throw them into something they can't. You know, it's very harmful for them, right? There is a lot of abuse around them. So I think it's very hard. It's not like there is not a particular recipe or a science for this.
Calling all humans who want to increase their skills. It's time to explore and deepen existing passions and get lost in creativity with Skillshare's online classes. What you find might just surprise and inspire you. Skillshare is an online learning community that offers memberships with a meaning. There's so much to explore and real projects to create, and the support of other fellow creators going on, Skillshare really empowers you just to accomplish growth and success in what you want to do. It's also incredibly affordable, especially when compared to pricey in-person classes and workshops. An annual subscription is less than £10 a month. I've really enjoyed the YouTube success tutorials, and also their productivity ones are just super useful for making you a more productive human. They're a great company, and they are very proud to be sponsoring the Growth Mindset podcast. So you can explore your creativity at skillshare.com/growth mindset and get 2 free months of premium membership. That's 2 whole months of unlimited access to thousands of different classes for free. Whether you want to learn to code or handstand, everything's there. Get started and join today by heading to skillshare.com/growth mindset. Again, that is skillshare.com/growth mindset.
We can pray. Are you still religious on this?
That's a very tough question. I do have faith. I wouldn't say I'm religious. No, I was brought up in a Catholic family, but I'm not particularly very religious person. And I wasn't actually. And one of the reasons it's very interesting, because my family, I was the youngest in my family. You know, my parents, we were seven siblings, right? Oh, wow. So my brother, he's older than me, the older brother, he was pretty much atheist. I mean, even he grew up he was atheist. He didn't believe. So he used to tell me, well, I don't believe in any of that. He believed more in science. And, you know, he had a degree in physics and math. So he was more of a mathematician. He was more into all these things about science and physics and all that. And my dad, he was very religious and Catholic, and my mother, right? So it's kind of very interesting. I had to kind of, you know, I was very religious growing up. You know, I was supposed to be a priest. That's why [S2] Wow. [S1] They named me Francis, a Catholic priest. And then when I found out, well, gee, a Catholic priest can't get married, I said, no way.
Yeah.
No, I think so. I would say I have faith. I believe in, of course, I believe in the evolution. I believe in the power. But sometimes you have to abstract things in life. You can't just, you know, seek for the answer. I mean, there's a lot of things we're seeking for, why we are here and how come we are here and what is the evolution process. I mean, you will never find an answer for that. So sometimes you have to abstract things and say, okay, I just believe in this. This is what it is, right? Mm-hmm. It's like you want to understand how an iPhone works. If you want to understand a computer or something like that, you have to go through the whole evolutions of the electric engineering and then transistors and then going to the, you know, all the digital technology and then moving into programming language. I mean, you will never understand exactly how a computer really functions in the details. So this is the same thing when it comes to really the evolution comes to our existence on this universe. So I believe that you have to have faith. You have to believe in something that is greater than you.
Yeah. Okay, so I wasn't sure. Certainly, I get a bit confused. Like, the more religions you sort of see, and it's just like, well, how are there so many people believing something completely different? Is everyone wrong to then like what I'm thinking, or are we all sort of half right? But none of us, we just kind of got like a weird flavor of our interpretation of it. And it's all a bit strange, especially when you think of like how, you know.
But religion, remember, religion is also, think about it, it's all about ideology.
Yeah.
Even in the political system we have right now, the environment we have in this world, people believing in something and it doesn't matter what's right and wrong. They don't rationalize. What do? They believe in it.
Mm.
It's like what's happening in this country. Like, you are either a Democrat or you're a Republican.
Yeah.
And sometimes people don't care. It's like, it's becoming an ideology, which is really dangerous. It's almost like religion, right?
Yep. Yeah, I fully agree with that. It sort of makes no real, well, everything that happens eventually makes sense. You can kind of work it out, but it's stupid and shouldn't be how things are working. And it's quite annoying. I agree that the way people look at political figures and just politics in general is a bit stupid, and you should definitely think more about what it is that you want rather than being on team A or team B and just sort of fighting over something that doesn't even matter. And yeah, it kind of just makes them us versus them, when actually half the time you'd all get on fine if you didn't sort of think about that problem. But anyway, politics, deep stuff.
Oh, that's a sign.
Yeah. Sweden. What was your favorite thing about Sweden?
My favorite things about Sweden is obviously the freedom that I had there in terms of,
I think it was like,
you know, I can speak up my mind.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the first thing I experienced coming from Iraq, that I can criticize anything. I can criticize the government. I can speak out about my political view or my religious, whatever beliefs, you know, without being put in jail or without,
nice.
You know, so that's it's the freedom that I've experienced was the most really amazing thing for me. And the other thing is, of course, I enjoy that free society, but also I enjoy the kind of the structure in Sweden. I mean, the way they are thinking, the way they've built their system in terms of the society, in terms of the, you know, welfare system.
I can definitely relate to your sense of freedom. Like, I mean, probably won't be half as much, as I didn't have like a whole livelihood that I had to escape. But I went to North Korea for only 6 days, but I remember just like the sort of weight off your shoulders when you can just suddenly talk about anything and like just walk down the street without someone saying you're not allowed to walk down the street, and just buy something that I wanted to buy and just do what the hell I wanted, and just suddenly realize that, oh, there isn't someone watching me 100% of the time, and just like, oh, it was such a relief. Yeah, that was quite special. Just something that you kind of never really realize how much we take for granted. And
yes, we do.
Help to do these things.
I don't take things for granted. I've been through, right? So I've been through Iraq, right? Until, you know, I was born in 1955 and then 77. So I grew up there. So I've seen a lot of things. So I don't take things for granted.
Yeah.
And even in the US, a lot of people do.
Definitely. And you kind of do when you just grow up with these things. You don't think about how special it is, what you have is, because it's sort of just life. You don't think, wow, this is amazing that I turned the tap and there was water and it was nice to drink. But when you get to other places and you can't even just like have a shower or use a tap or anything, it's suddenly like, oh, wow, my life is so lovely. It's kind of funny. And yeah, you think of, yeah, when you look back at history and people were sort of worried about how much money we'd have when we were automating things and stuff. And this, like, actually, we're all super rich now, but it's just we don't realize the price of what it is that we have. So all the things that we're used to are kind of things that people didn't have like a few hundred years ago. And you kind of live with like shit healthcare and like horrible food and like a tiny house and bad living things. And people who think that they're poor these days actually have like really nice stuff that like would only be the most expensive thing that you could even have had 200 years ago and better than what people even had then. We have no idea about that because that was like 200 years ago. Anyway, deep stuff.
Yeah, so, I mean, I as you know, I was born in Northern Iraq. In Northern Iraq, my family were a farmer. We had no electricity, no running water. You can imagine that, right?
Yeah.
So being there in Northern Iraq without electricity, without running water, living in a farm, in a village, and now I'm in the Silicon Valley driving an electric car, a Tesla.
Yeah, nice.
Okay. So you can imagine the contrast between that life and this life. So yeah, I never figured that, right? And living also in a country that was pretty much a dictatorship, you know, no freedom at all. And then moving to Sweden and then coming to the United States and experience all have different experience.
You know? Yeah. So you may have had to have told the story a few times, but how did you exactly escape? Did you take a plane? Did you hitchhike? What's the process of getting to
Sweden? No, I did basically take a plane because I actually got a visa to Sweden. So I was able to pretty much quietly leave Iraq, you know, without having to. So I was very lucky to get my passport. And at the time, 1977, was probably easy to get the passport. And I was able to get the visa and pretty much that's it. It was one way.
Yeah.
And it was not a way. It was a round trip ticket. I couldn't book just one way. Otherwise, you know, they'll be suspicious about it.
Yeah.
But definitely it was very scary when I was leaving the airport. I say, I'm praying nobody's going to stop me or say, oh, okay, where are you going? What are you going to do in Sweden? Yeah, of course, there are a bunch of questions. It was just the moment once I was in the airplane and I landed in Denmark, Copenhagen. And I said, oh, I felt so free. It's like, okay, now I don't have to go back. But then, of course, you miss your family. But then my family came to Sweden after a year. So everybody escaped Iraq. So, so my brother and sisters and my parents, you know, my sister and brothers, they all live in Sweden. So
cool. And then, so they all stayed in Sweden. Did they come to US as well? Or was that like another, like you went first and then everyone else followed?
Yeah, no, they didn't follow me to the US. Basically, they stayed there. In the US, the reason why I came here, because it was mostly because of the high tech. I got a pretty interesting job offer in Dallas, Texas. And that's when I moved to Dallas, Texas. And then after that, I worked for a few years for that company. You know, and then I worked for DSC Communications that was bought by Alcatel. And then I worked for Ericsson. So we went back again to Sweden for a couple of years working with Ericsson and kind of remind me about Sweden. And that's what I was telling you a story about. You know, I went there. That was in early 90s. And I was, you know, making pretty good money. And I said, wow, that's a pretty good salary in Sweden. And then on top of it, of course, they were paying for my apartment in a very nice area. But I didn't know about the tax laws. Well, the tax bracket, I was 70%. But on top of that, whatever they were paying and for my apartment, that added actually to my income. I was not receiving that money. So they taxed me on that. And I felt, oh my God, I felt like I was making a lot of money, but I was poor. And I didn't quite understand that. So that's why I say, okay, this is not going to work for me. You know, we better go back to US, you know?
Yeah. So Sweden is just a really nice place. And I think if you used to it, then you kind of accept that you're paying tax to be somewhere really nice. And the Swedish people aren't so bothered about tax because they feel like the tax is actually is supporting them. Whereas like in US and stuff, you kind of feel like any tax that you pay is just like money lost. Whereas in Sweden, you're like, oh, well, I have this amazing thing. And you kind of understand it a bit more. It's different ways of looking at it as well. I certainly feel like the Swedish people feel like the people spending their tax are doing a good job of it. Whereas in America, I don't really want to trust Trump or something with my money kind of thing. So the less tax I could be paying, the better. There's quite a lot of things to go into. I'm not sure we're really going to have time to cover anything. So I guess I'd really like to know how you started your first businesses, what your lessons were from failures, and how you ended up getting into OpenVPN.
Yeah, I mean, starting my business, obviously, at the time I was working for Ericsson. And in Ericsson, I have a different experience there in terms of working for the company. And I was always a person that thought outside the box. I was always thinking about idea and proposing different solution for Ericsson. And a lot of these things, you know, when you're working for the big company, it takes time. It takes, you know, a lot of effort to really mobilize the people around you and around the idea, right? So a lot of ideas and the things I had, the vision I had, even within Ericsson about voice over IP. And at Ericsson, we were working with this technology called ATM, asynchronous transfer mode. And I was trying to sell the idea to Ericsson that everything is moving toward internet. Everything is moving toward IP. And it was very hard for Ericsson to really move toward that direction, right? And my vision was like, everything is going to move over IP, even the voice, even the video. That's really the future. That's what you need to gear the company to, toward, whether it's your mobile phone, whether, you know. So that's really, I learned a lot about that and really how to work with people. So that was quite a very interesting experience. So I decided, okay, I'm just going to leave Ericsson and start on my own. It doesn't seem this kind of culture fits me very well. I was thinking about things way, way ahead of a lot of these companies. So that's when I started my first venture, which actually it was an easy venture because that was mostly in service industry. So I was providing mostly consulting services, was called Newcom Technology, but also developed technology that was related to packet switching and routings and all that. So my first contract was really through Ericsson. Ericsson was one of my biggest customers. So that first venture, so this is an interesting experience, Newcom Technology, I made a lot of money out of it. And I say, wow, this is easy. So I was like 41. When I came to US, I was 31 years old. And in 10 years, here I end up, you know, with millions of dollars. And I say, well, gee, this was easy. So I guess I can do it again, right? Even more. But I think I was naive because I didn't learn much from the success, honestly, at that time. So now I started another company and then I went into Packet Stream. That was quite of a struggle because, yes, I raised money and we were able to get the momentum. We were able to get the product and it was mostly in quality of service. I was trying to solve this problem of quality of service on the internet and IP. I say, well, IP is just a datagram. There's no quality. So I came from more telecom background. So I say, okay, we can somehow separate these streams and treat them differently, you know, manage them differently. And so that's when and actually I had a patent there called synchronous packet switching. If you actually search that, you will see I've got a patent that was in the 90s. So we were quite successful with that kind of product, and we actually sold it to telecom and all that. But then somehow we got caught in the middle of the dot-com crash. And when the dot-com crash came, we didn't know how to, we were just basically thinking about just building the company. And a lot of venture capitalists were telling us, don't worry about the money. Think about the money is already there. Just basically scale. And that's what we were doing. We were spending money like crazy without thinking about the cash flow, right? So I was the CEO for the company. And then we hire a CEO. And somehow my board of directors saying, well, hire a CEO. And then I say, okay, I stay as a chairman, as a CTO, as a chief technical officer. We hire a CEO who sold the company for hundreds of millions of dollars, but he really didn't have the experience of really how to take this company. And basically at the time the dot-com crash came in and we were supposed to raise more money. And then a lot of VC was put in frozen mode. We're not going to invest anymore. We're going to see what's going to happen. We're going to see what's happening. Then in 2001, September 11, 9/11 happened. Everything was going just downhill. And we decided, we didn't per se bankrupt the company, but I decided to close the company. This is not going anywhere. I need to start all over. So that failure, that process that I went through, it really, I learned a lot. I learned a lot about in terms of, okay, hey, you can't take things for granted. You can't just leave these things in terms of the cash flow and not manage cash flow. You know, it's all about being a little bit more strategic, but also it's about looking at low hanging fruit. So that failure gave me a good experience. I say, okay, I'm not going to give up. Then I got involved in the Future of Iraq project in 2003 when U.S. wanted to liberate or invade Iraq or change the system. So I spent some time there, 6 months in Iraq, and I started also some projects related to telecom. So I was able to make pretty good money from some of the projects related to telecom and voice over IP and so on. I worked with a few investors in Jordan. And so I was able to recover and make some money. In 2000, actually, it was 2004, 2005, and I realized Iraq is not going to go anywhere. I mean, this is like, there were just too many problems. So I decided, okay, I need to do something here. So that's when actually in 2005, somehow I met James, and James was working with his open source projects, OpenVPN. And so I had an idea. I say, oh, okay, James, I think the internet is not very secure. What about if we build this layer of security more on the cloud, more on basically we build a VPN service, but also we've been build a VPN this as a software rather than hardware appliances. Because typically VPN was known for these boxes. You buy a box, playing with the open source as a project. It wasn't really a real business. And I say, let's get together. I have a few investors that I know. I have some friends, you know. So we teamed up together, you know, have the OpenVPN as a business. He's the co-founder of the company as well. That was, you know, we started working gradually with each other. We didn't exactly. So I formed the company in 2005. It was a different name. And then we renamed it to OpenVPNing. And then we started developing the product. And then we were able to launch the product, you know, in 2009. And from there on, basically, it pretty much took off OpenVPN amazingly. And now we're in at the stage of really scaling the business going. We're very profitable. We're scaling. We've got close to more 60 people around the world. We've got engineers in Europe and in US, and we're more of a distributed team. So that was very interesting for me to be introduced to the open source kind of mentality or the culture, completely different, where you work for a company like Ericsson. Traditionally, you build a whole organization and you're building engineering. And here you're thinking about, you have open source, and open source people think more freely and more the code is open to everybody. And it's mostly they are more interested in the work rather than money. It's really that's what drives them, because they're interested in the space. So that was a very interesting model. And we say, well, let's build a culture around this to have autonomy, to give people that autonomy, give them that freedom, but at the same time, making sure that we hire people that not to tell them what to do. We have to hire smart people to tell us what to do. Yeah. So that was really the kind of philosophy. And I think this is not only my philosophy, is actually, if you read Steve Jobs, this is one of the Steve Jobs' philosophy, you know, that you don't hire people that you tell them what to do. You have to hire smart people to tell you what to do. That has been a little bit, for us, very challenging to find those kind of people, right? That, hey, if you basically are part of this company and organization, you have to start thinking outside of the box. You have to take initiatives to do things, you know. You know, everything is not going to be perfect. This is something is evolving and it's something is growing. That's basically the story of OpenVPN. And now, I mean, we have a very big name in the industry, and OpenVPN has been used by thousands and thousands, and we have close to 1 million downloads a month, and, you know, it's really growing. And we have a vision, obviously. The vision we have is to build the idea is to have existing application running in the layers. So we're going to be launching a new product by the end of the year. It's our own cloud. And that's targeting, you know, mostly businesses. And the idea of that cloud is really to build another secure layer on top of the internet that you can construct your network. I call it VPN on demand. So on demand, you would be able to do site to site. You would be able to do remote access. You would be able to do a lot of things on the basically online and on the web pretty much, but we have the infrastructure to allow you to build. It's like a tool box, but it's really on the cloud itself to allow you to interconnect, you know, all the resources, all the sites you have, your users, and provide access control and provide the level of security you need. So pretty much reinventing kind of the network and changing this space of VPN, also moving the VPN not just as a tunneling technology, but also as a really inclusive with everything, because tunneling is only the encryption and moving the data from point A to point B, but also there is access control, there is filtering, you know, malware detection and threat management.
Nice.
Here's an advert that listeners will be interested in. Orgain's grants for greater good. Orgain is a company who are giving away $150,000 in grant money. Orgain is a startup business working in nutrition, mind-body wellness, and promoting healthy lifestyles. Yeah, it was started by their founder, Andrew, just to kind of provide a convenient, clean nutrition product, and seems to be doing very well, so much so that they're now giving away money to help other people on the mission of making people healthier. So basically what you need to know is that they're going to choose 3 startups to grant them each $50,000 to take their business to the next level. To apply for the program, your startup needs to be 2 years old and in the business of promoting healthy, vibrant lives, either through nutrition, active lifestyles, or mindfulness. And the application period ends on March the 20th, 2020. So if you think that you're fit, just visit orgain.com/grants today to learn more. Now, Orgain is spelled O-R-G-A-I-N. So orgain.com/grants to learn more.
Yeah, I was going to say maybe it's a good time for me to stop, because I kind of wanted to dig into a few things that you alluded to before going into the importance of VPNs and things and how they work. So yeah, enjoy your sip. And the first kind of big topic I wanted to go into from what you just spoke about was, how do you make a business out of something that's open source? Because open source is like designed sort of free and everyone can access it. So how do you then take something that people are using and creating and actually make a business out of it? Because if it's something that I quite like open source things, but I don't know how I can then spend time being open source and helping people do it commercially.
So typically an open source, it's a technology. It's think of it as a toolbox, a bunch of software. But it takes quite an experienced person, really an IT person or a programmer, to put the software together to make it work. So you're going to invest a lot of money as a company to really putting all these open source tools to make some use out of it, whether it's you provide a better management interface, better UI, all that stuff needs more engineering. So the OpenVPN, it's only the core of the VPN. It doesn't have all the management aspects. It doesn't have all the UI, everything. So what we've done from a commercial point of view, we've added that value add on top of it, that we package it and we simplify that to our businesses, especially small to medium sized businesses. Okay, if you are a big enterprise and you have the programmers and you have all the infrastructure, you can spend millions of dollars, hundreds of thousands of dollars to do that, you can do that. But if you're a small to medium sized businesses, how are you going to do that? You want to deploy that easily with just a simple, maybe an IT person or a computer person that, you know how to set up the software and set it up for you, but still have the solution where it has all the management capability, it has all the UI, it has that simplification. So the idea is to take an open source that is complex software and transform that more simplified, basically building blocks that is targeted, very well targeted in a specific market that you're really solving a problem that's going to be very economical for that particular company. As an example, you could deploy VPN if you're a company of 10 people, and all you have to pay is probably $50 or $60 a month. I mean, how many people you can hire to pay $50, $60 a month, right? So you solve a problem, the security, for your company. It's a small company. Even if you're a 100-people company, you're paying only $1,000 or a couple of thousand dollars a month and $10,000 a year. It's not a lot of money comparing if you were to hire a person or a couple of people to really put the open source solutions for you. Yeah, but if you are Google, have the resources and you have the money, you can do it.
Sure. How would then, you spoke about like getting a really smart team together. How do you go about hiring people? Like, what's your favorite questions to ask people? How do you select them? Where do you find them?
Well, most of the people we found specifically, they're different type of people. At the core, when it comes to open source, we found them through our community. So here is the thing, is most of the people we hire at the core of the development, they were contributing already to open source project because they were interested in it. Okay, there is some level of how a magnetic or gravity there where people come to the project and they want to contribute, they want to work with it. Either they're trying to solve a problem and they get very interested in it and they like the technology. So that's the first level of basically we where we find the people, right? And the other thing is just through the normal process of recruitment. We have technical recruiters, we have people really trying to bring the best people, and we have certain criteria of hiring when we're hiring people. I mean, obviously for us, it's very hard because there's a lot of these people can work for bigger companies, but they can't work for us because they really have to take the initiatives to do things, and we make it very clear to them. Here's what we're doing. This is what we have. This is the technology. This is where our vision is. So we have to treat this as a sales job too. I mean, as a CEO, you are really a salesperson all the time because you have to sell your idea even to the people you're hiring. So it's not only we look at them and look at their qualification. Of course, we're going to look at their qualification. But at the same time, if you find a person that's really very smart and very experienced and really you want them to be part of your company, now it's your job. You have to convince them. So, and you have to go about it is a selling job. The selling job, it's a process. So you, of course, you talk about the vision, you talk about the company, but also you connect them with the most qualified people in the organization. Here are the people you're going to be working with. You're going to be working with James, the co-founder. You're going to be working with this core team. So they see the competency of the company. They see the vision, and you get them excited. And once you get them excited, then you close it.
Yeah, lastly, getting onto VPNs and things. So why is it so important for companies to have a VPN these days and like the whole data protection and all sorts of things? Like, does every small business need a VPN?
Well, I mean, I think the VPN has different use cases. So definitely you need a VPN, specifically if your organization is a distributed. Unless you want to concentrate all your resources and all your data in your office, typically these days, everything is moving toward the cloud, everything is on the internet, everything is SaaS. You know, you have so many different access from different points, and you have employee, your organization working remotely. You have your resources, your data stored in the cloud. You have SaaS. And you have another problem. It's you have a lot of threats and you have a lot of, you know, you're on the cyber, you're on the internet. So what do you do all this stuff? How do you, the reason why you need VPN, you need a point of what I call concentration, a point of concentration where you want to tunnel all the traffic to a point where you want to examine that traffic. You want to add a level of protections before it leaves your network. So that level of concentration could be on your cloud. So you have to deploy VPN and you have to make it part of your solution. You say every point, every device, every employee has to connect to the VPN first because I want to see all that traffic. I want to make sure, ensure this traffic is going through some level of firewalling, some level of threat management and threat monitoring, because you're surfing the internet through that. So I want to make sure I block all the malicious attacks and all that stuff. Beside that, if I have some data that's available only on my private cloud, then basically you need a VPN in order to access. And also I want to define access control, what kind of access control you can have and so on, right? And now even with the SaaS tools, a lot of the SaaS providers basically are imposing the idea, location security. What is the location security? The location security is basically like if you're using Salesforce as a CRM, right? So CRM, Salesforce, a lot of companies are saying, we don't want to have our employee going from anywhere, say you are right now in Israel, and you're logging into Salesforce while your IP address is coming from Israel. Well, a lot of businesses are saying, no, we want to make it location secure. That means I want to make sure that my employee goes through the VPN and goes through all the authentication layer. And I want to make sure the source where this coming, it's coming from my source, from my location, which is say if I'm on a cloud, I have a specific IP address. That's the only way you're going to let them in to be authenticated into the CRM system. And actually Salesforce doesn't implement that kind of source. I call it the source or the location security. So there's a lot of things, if you look at this, from remote access, from threat management and threat monitoring, but also from a location security, the VPN is going to be very, very essential.
Cool. Okay. One other thing to backtrack into is you said you went back to Iraq and Syria to help set up communications and things. Like, what process did that entail exactly? Were you sort of working in an office? Were you helping putting lines up?
No, I hired a team of engineer there, and we were bidding on some of the projects. And one of the projects we bid on, it was to build a mobile network in Iraq and Baghdad. So that's one of the projects we were trying to get. And there was also another projects doing internet access for a specific area, setting up voice over IP, because everything there, the whole infrastructure was pretty much all down, right? Yeah. I mean, there was no mobile network. I mean, everything was bombed. There was also a project of fiber optics. So I had a very close relationship with the telecom ministry as well, working with them and trying to, so it was mostly more on the, it wasn't as much fun. It was mostly in building the infrastructure and mostly, building a solution that at least you can get the network running from an internet perspective, telephony. So it's basic stuff, right? Bringing equipment and building and more on in the operation side of the business. And that was very interesting for me in terms of putting the entire bit together and walking through the entire process, how to build, how to work with vendors such as Motorola and Ericsson, and building the entire solutions, So I was kind of an architect, so I understood all these components. So I was able to build a team and get some projects. So that was a very short time, basically. And then I got out of that because things were getting out of control there in terms of the security.
Yeah,
and that wasn't particularly my interest. My interest was mostly in innovation and solution technology and really building something new.
Okay, cool. Sounds like a fascinating time to do that. So yeah, back to new things, leads into my next question of where do you see the industry going in 5 years' time?
Well, industry as a whole or more in the security space?
Yeah, more in the security space of your specific skill set.
Well, I think in the security space there are different components of it. There's the components of the, I would say, the access is how do you access services, whether it's a SaaS, whether it's, and so from the access perspective, I do see that the industry is moving toward a level where we're going to have more level of concentration, where we're going to concentrate all our resources and the services around the cloud. Everything is going to be a cloud. I don't believe that the industry is going to have things on the premise, maybe for backup and other things. But from a security perspective, I believe VPN is going to play that role in terms of being the connectivity layers, the tunneling layer that you can connect all these devices into network and think of that as a network, as a virtual. But then you have another layer on top of it, where it's all about threat management and cybersecurity and all that. So I think industry is going to move toward that kind of system where we have to move the security, because the security is moving from the on-device. Now it's everything, it's online. Everything is about cybersecurity. So I believe we're going to have a kind of more a layer of security on top of the internet. That's where the industry is really moving. So you see some companies are more focusing on, the antivirus business is pretty much, moving toward more online, toward more cybersecurity rather than, you know, somebody is trying to install a virus on your machine, right? I believe this, so there are multiple components there, but everything is moving toward more cloud rather than on the device or on the premise. I don't know if I answered your question.
I feel like it's probably worth asking you a few more questions around it. So what do you think about the advent of 5G in terms of security? Is that going to be a good thing, a bad thing, or not too sure about it?
Well, the 5G, obviously, that's an interesting thing because the 5G is going to give us the ability to basically increase the bandwidth. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of the security, I wouldn't say that the 5G is going to give us a better security. It's going to give more power in the hands of the hackers and in the hands of the bad actors, I would say, that to really take advantage of that and launch more malicious attack and being able to do more distributed attacks. And so that could work against us. But the nice things about 5G is obviously accessibility to high bandwidth and basically having you know, videos and having multimedia and virtual reality enabling some amazing maybe applications. So
okay. Is there anything about the future of blockchain that you think is going to be enhanced or become worse with security?
Well, the blockchain is like any kind of distributed, any kind of peer-to-peer, right? There are some risks associated with that. I mean, this is one of the things why some of the companies are taking these things up on themselves, like somebody like Facebook is trying to take that blockchain technology and implementing this, the whole idea of Libra, right? Where they have, you know, the currency where people can, because you have a trusted, you know, entity that you can trust, right? So, but I don't know about blockchain. It's a great technology. I mean, like any other technology. But in terms of the security, definitely you've got now more of a peer-to-peer relationships. And so it has a different applications, right? But at the same time, also, it has some other disadvantage. When you distribute things and when you make it peer-to-peer, then the bad actors come in and take advantage of the technology, and you will see a lot of, and you're seeing already, you know, a lot of frauds, a lot of problems that comes along with it too.
Going into some more random questions. What's your earliest ever memory or most vivid memory from childhood?
Good memory or bad memories?
it could be bad. It's just vivid.
My vivid memory, obviously, there are two part of it. One part was when I was a child, obviously growing in a farm. It was beautiful, you know, farm, and you know, we have everything. We had a good life, you know, with all the animals and good food and good fruits and vegetables and all that. But also, I have a vivid memory about the war. Basically, all I remember was just the bombing and the running away, and our home was destroyed. We had to really hide and escape, and we were living in caves actually for a few days before we were able to escape the war and then go to Baghdad. So, and also, of course, my memories in Baghdad, like we were pretty much lost, you know. You know, very poor, and you know, the whole family was, you imagine, you know, parents with seven siblings all sleeping in one room and trying to survive and find ways to, you know, survive. You know, that was, you know, those are the memories, yeah. I have, you know.
That's deep. Thanks for sharing. Then the best piece of advice you've been given?
Well, I've been given the best advice, actually, that I've been given. I always had a mentor, David Kaplan, who's on my advisory board. And the best advice he gave me, he'd say, look, when you're running a business, if you are in red, time is your enemy. In red, meaning this is a financial term is being used when you're negative cash flow. You're basically, you raise money, and then you start building and building and building, but then you're not reaching your goal. So what happened next? Well, you have to raise more money. So when you are in red, meaning, you know, you're losing more than what you're making, then time is your enemy. But when you are in black, meaning when you have positive cash flow, you're making more than what you're spending, then time is your friend. So that's the best advice.
Okay, that's interesting. So yeah.
When you are in red, time is your enemy. And when you are in black, time is your friend.
That's an interesting way of looking at it. It's definitely completely true. Because it just makes you kind of not want to ever relax when you're in red. But then does that not potentially leave you at the sort of thinking, oh, I'm just in black, I'll do nothing, and just like wait?
No,
then,
no, yeah. Actually, in black doesn't mean you're going to do nothing. In black, you still have to watch your number. So there's something as a CEO, as an entrepreneur, you have to do is you have to look at your key performance indicators, the KPI, and what are your key performance indicators. So one of the things that I've learned through this, something I call quick ratio. What is a quick ratio? A quick ratio is really the number of new customers you're getting in divided by the number of customers you're losing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if your quick ratio is about, it has to be above 1 or 2, you have to make sure you control that. That's like a leaky bucket. You've got a bucket, you've got leaky bucket, you're losing customer, but then you've got new customers coming in. So you have to retain more customers than what you're losing. So that's very challenging in a business. How do you do that? What does it take? Well, it's a product. Is it, do I have to improve the product? Do I have to improve my customer success management? I mean, my sales, when I'm nurturing my customers, how do I control my churn? How do I take my churn rate down? How do I increase my conversion? How do I bring more leads through marketing, through partnership? So there's a lot of these things. Just because you're in black doesn't mean you're going to stay stagnated or you're going to go down. You still have to manage the business and manage it to grow. Otherwise, you're going to be out of business, right? Yeah, I mean, that's how it is. So KPI for any entrepreneur and executive, it's very, very important. You have to decide what's your KPI. But even if you start measuring, because the data is going to be everything for you as a business. If you don't have data, you basically have no idea what's going on in your business, not just looking at your revenue. You have to look at these key performance indicators and looking at your customers. Where are they coming from? How many new customers are you getting? How many customers are you losing? And when you have this kind of data, what are you going to do about it? Why are you losing customers? Why your churn rate is high? Is it the product? Is it the customer journey? Is it something else? You have to find out. And then you have to basically come up with a solution and implement that and execute that. Whether it's part of it goes into your marketing, part of it goes into the customer success. So it's not just building the product. Like as a company, we started with a product. We have a technology. We had no idea. When we built a product, we thought, well, everything is great. So the product, people are buying and buying and buying and buying. And then we find out, wait a minute, but we need more customers. So now you have to do marketing. So now you have to build a marketing engine. How do you do your inbound marketing? What kind of content marketing are you going to do? What kind of PR are you going to do? What kind of social media? Do you do advertising? And then you have to measure this. You have to measure, is your marketing engine working? And then on top of that, you have to do business development. You have to have strategic partnership. What kind of partnership? What kind of, you know, how can you strengthen this so you can leverage on maybe teaming up with a cloud provider, whatever. So now when you bring all these leads, you're generating that. Okay, you say, that's great, we're leads. But then you're saying, well, gee, they're not converting. So how do I convert them? Then you say, well, you need to establish a customer success team. And a customer success team is taking part of the success team is allowing them, take them through that journey. Do I convert them? How do I convert them? And basically, when I convert them to use my product, are they satisfied with product? And nurture that customer. And then you end up seeing, well, gee, I'm losing customers. Why am I losing them? Well, my churn rate is high here. So now you have to build a strategy around your customer success. How do you keep those customers and retain those customers? So in an organization, it's a very challenging. It's not just you're building the technology and you're building the product. You have to be able to build all these different engines, right? Yeah. And then you've got the operational aspects too. You know, you're building a cloud. You have the entire operation team to build this. because you're developing, you're going to deploy it, and then you're going to push it to the marketplace and to your customers. And so everything has its own, and it's quite of an interesting, and this is how you can scale the business. You cannot scale the business by just building a product, a cool product, and you think everything's going to take off, right?
Yeah, it's the whole like iterative feedback going through the whole circle of like life pretty much that you just explained, and getting your data and improving things and then going to the next point, getting your data, improving things and following it all round and round and forever loop basically of making things better and getting more customers and satisfying them more, and et cetera. But yeah, thanks very much for the much more than one piece of advice there, I think. that was great. Okay. Then finally, what's the kindest thing someone's ever done for you?
What is the kindest things ever somebody done for me? I haven't thought about that. I think most people around me are pretty kind to me. So I would say the kindest things is really the advice I get from people around me. That's the kindest things I get from people. So I don't know. That's kind of a tough question. How would I think about it? You know, my kids are very kind to me, so that's great. I mean, the kindest things that I ever like is when I go and hear my daughter singing, but also the kindest things I see when, you know, I see my daughter, the other daughter, she's, you know, building the marketing engine, and she is really building it with such a, you know, passion and interest. And so, you know, that's the kindest things that I see and in my life right now, to see my kids moving forward in their life and be happy. And, you know,
cool. Yeah, I wondered, I thought you might say like Sweden letting you in or something. It's like, I'm not sure if it's really one person exactly, but had a big effect.
Yeah, I mean, Sweden, of course, had a big effect in me, obviously. But I can't think, because there are so many people have been kind to me, right?
Yeah, it's a hard question.
So it's a very hard question. Yeah. So if I would say the kindest thing, it was probably, yeah, when I think about it, it's Sweden. I mean, Sweden obviously opened their arm, and I was able to, you know, get political asylum there, and I was able to, you know, get through my education. So that was very kind of Sweden, and I always consider Sweden as my country as well, and US, America too.
Yeah, of course, before they try and kick you out or something. We love the US. You're fine. Okay, cool. Have you got any final questions for me, or is there something I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
No, I'm fine. This is good.
Nice. Okay.
Sorry about the connections, and, you know.
Yeah,
thank you. Appreciate your time, Sam.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for telling your story.
I hope this was useful for you. So
yeah, it's really interesting and fascinating. Lots of stuff to kind of dig into and like food for thought. It's great.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day.
Yeah. You too. And yeah, okay. Everything, life. Awesome.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is @GrowthMindsetPodcast, or follow me @SamJamSnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram. If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.